and repents of his sin. We must keep in mind that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves all of his servants and is more careful to them than their mothers. And that is why Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh advised us to fight against our depression in the mercy of God. Thank you very much. Until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Attack is armed with automatic weapons have opened fire at the Crocus City Hall, a shopping center and concert venue in the Russian capital Moscow. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Russia's RT network, Russia Today, has covered this story and tells us more. Multiple videos posted on social media on Friday evening, 22nd of March, showed a moment a mass shooting took place at a shopping center and concert venue in the Russian capital, Moscow. According to preliminary reports by eyewitnesses, mass assailants opened fire with automatic rifles and used hand grenades. Video footage indicates that at least five gunmen were involved in the attack. Official information about the incident is still pending. One video shows people inside a packed concert hall, part of the Crocus City Hall complex, milling about. Someone shouts, "Close the door," right before gunshots are heard, and then screaming begins. Another video captured the sounds of automatic gunfire in the shopping center echoing from the abandoned galleries. The roof of Crocus City Hall has reportedly started to crumble after reports of an explosion or an incendiary device going off at the concert hall emerged. According to preliminary estimates by Russia's Federal Security Service, the FSB, at least 40 people have been killed in the attack. Separately, the Health Ministry of Moscow region has shared a list of 144 people who were injured in the incident. The attackers struck right before a concert of the rock band Picnic, scheduled for Friday evening, 22nd of March, at one end of the sprawling shopping complex in Moscow region. According to RIA Novosti, at least three attackers opened fire inside the venue and used an incendiary bomb to start a fire. Police and emergency services have responded to the scene. There has been no information about the identity or motives of the attackers. The Crocus City Hall is located in Moscow region, right outside the administrative boundary of the Russian capital. The complex includes a concert hall, an aquarium, and a wedding venue, along with many shops and restaurants. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin has cancelled all large-scale events in the Russian capital after a shooting at the Krokus City Hall, one of the biggest music venues just outside of the city. A group of gunmen was reportedly responsible for the spree of violence. Sergei Sobyanin called the incident a terrible tragedy and asked Moscovites to understand his decision to ban all gatherings for the weekend. "I extend my condolences to the families of those who were killed. I have ordered all necessary assistance to those affected," he wrote on social media. Few details about the shooting have been officially confirmed so far, except that it has resulted in multiple deaths. Video footage circulating online indicates the attackers were armed with automatic weapons and dressed in tactical gear. The American broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story and tells us more. ISIS, also known as Daesh terrorists, claimed responsibility for a deadly attack at Moscow's Krokus City Hall, where at least 60 people were killed and over 145 others were wounded on Friday evening, 22nd of March, according to Russian officials. Gunmen opened fire at the hall, which is one of the biggest shopping and entertainment complexes in Russia, and a large fire began after the shooting, which rapidly engulfed the complex, according to Russian officials. Daesh, or ISIS terrorists, released a statement later on in the evening, claiming their people attacked a big gathering in the Russian capital, Moscow, in a statement injuring hundreds and causing major destruction. Russia's foreign ministry called the incident a terrorist attack. It's the largest terror attack in central Russia in terms of the number of victims since the Domodedovo airport bombing in January of 2011 that killed 37 people and injured a further 172. The attack began at around 8 p.m. local time on Friday evening, 22nd of March, when a group of at least five gunmen stormed the complex during a concert by the band Picnic and opened fire with automatic weapons, according to Russia's RIA Novosti news agency. More than 70 ambulance teams were sent to the site of the attack, according to Moscow Region Governor Andrei Vorobyov. Two firefighting helicopters are also on the scene trying to put out the fire. Of those injured, at least 115 people were hospitalized, including five children. The Russian Health Minister, Mikhail Murashko, said in a statement, "One child and 60 adults are listed in serious condition," according to the health minister. Most of the building is engulfed in fire and the roof has partially collapsed. The cause of the fire is unknown, but unconfirmed reports said there was an explosion inside the concert hall. A U.S. official told ABC News the U.S. shared intelligence with Russia about the risk of an imminent threat posed by ISIS terrorists, also known as Daesh terrorists. In Podolsk, near Moscow, public events were cancelled due to the incident at Krokus City Hall. The mayor of Moscow also cancelled all sports, cultural and other mass events in Moscow for the weekend. The Kremlin said Russian President Vladimir Putin was informed of the attack when the shooting started and he has been receiving constant updates about the situation. Meanwhile, the White House is also aware of the incident in Moscow but has limited information as of now, according to the U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby. The Moscow Times has also covered this story. A group of armed men opened fire at a concert hall in a Moscow suburb on Friday night, 22nd of March, killing at least 60 people and injuring 145 others, Russian authorities are saying. A video shared online showed at least two masked men entering the Crocus City Hall, with one repeatedly firing shots from what appeared to be an assault rifle. According to a journalist who was at Crocus City Hall during the time of the attack, a grenade or an incendiary bomb was thrown after the shooting broke out and caused a fire. Video footage published by Russia's TASS news agency showed a large fire at Crocus City Hall, which is located around 16 kilometers northwest of the center of Moscow. Later on Friday, 22nd of March, the ISIS terror group, also known as Daesh terrorists, claimed responsibility for the attack, according to a post on Daesh's Telegram channel. Shortly following initial news reports of the shooting, Moscow region governor Andrei Vorobyov said he had arrived at the scene and was leading response effort to the incident. More than 70 ambulance teams were working near Crocus City Hall, and medical staff were helping those who had been injured. Spetsnaz and riot police units were sent in response to the incident, the TASS news agency has reported. Russian Interior Minister Vladimir Kolokoltsev also arrived at the scene, according to the RIA Novosti news agency.
May 28, 2016 was no ordinary day at the Cincinnati Zoo in Ohio. Something had happened in Old Zoo that became the headline of the world's news agencies in less than a few minutes.
Well, what we know is that around 4 p.m., zoo officials say they started hearing people screaming around the gorilla enclosure and then quickly sealed off the area. And this is what they saw when they came on the scene, Renee.
In fact, this incident was related to a gorilla, a 17-year-old gorilla named Harambe, who came to Cincinnati only 2 years ago. Eyewitnesses told about the unwanted entry of a 4-year-old child into Harambe's special enclosure, an enclosure that didn't seem easy to get out of. Tension rose among the visitors as Harambe approached the child. A few moments later, when he moved the boy to another part of his enclosure, tension and anxiety increased even more. 15 minutes had passed from the moment the child entered Harambe's enclosure, when the zoo officials made an important decision, firing a series of shots to put an end to that chaotic day. Ancient petroglyphs prove that the relationship between humans and animals is as old as human history. A relationship that includes hunting, taming, and sometimes entertainment. It was the year 2009 when archaeologists discovered an amazing area in Egypt. The area dates back to 3500 BC, an area full of elephant's bones as well as rhinoceros, all kinds of monkeys and felidae, which was apparently built for keeping animals. This important discovery confirmed that Egyptian pharaohs were the first to build something similar to a zoo. Of course, the tradition of keeping animals existed in other parts of the world as well. Regions like Greece, Rome, Babylon, Iran, China, India, and Africa. In addition, European kings were very fond of animals.
Elephants are a notable example. In the wild, they walk up to 50 miles a day. Yet in zoos, these social and cognitively complex animals are confined in enclosed spaces where they can suffer from arthritis and joint pain. A study on African elephants showed that the average lifespan of African elephants in European zoos is less than 17 years, which is less than half the average lifespan of African elephants who are killed by poachers in the wild. And when the study looked at African elephants not affected by poaching, their average lifespan was 56 years in the wild, or more than three times as long as those kept in European zoos.
But the only problem of zoos is not keeping animals from their natural living conditions. On the other hand, intentionally or unintentionally, many animals are poisoned in zoos, sometimes by the strange foods of the visitors and sometimes by rotten or inappropriate meals. They may starve for many hours on holidays. They may not receive timely and effective veterinary treatment due to illness. Another part of the story is related to private zoos. Mysterious places full of special animals that exist in the US more than any other country. Three of the most interesting examples of these zoos are in the states of Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Florida. Three zoos with three controversial owners, Joe Exotic, Doc Antle, and Carol Baskin. Joe Exotic started his career with juggling and performing animal shows. A strange man who decided to build his own private zoo in an empty plot of land in Oklahoma in 1999. Now the vastness and facilities of his zoo are the talk of the town. A zoo that is considered a place for him to socialize with his favorite animals. The relationship between him and his tigers is a strange one, a relationship that encourages visitors to pay a significant fee to watch it. At Joe's zoo, getting close to the animals is a normal thing. Touching and caressing them is considered a part of the visit, and he himself participates in it. His armed employees are either busy taking care of the animals or protecting them 24/7. On the other hand, Joe also runs an internet program every day, a program that, along with several music albums, has managed to attract the attention of his fans.
I wake up, I go to work, but every day I get someone trying to slam me down back in the dirt. I don't care, I move on.
His products store is one of the most popular and profitable parts of this zoo. A store focused on tigers and other felidae. Doc Antle has a similar territory as Joe in South Carolina. a territory with wild animals and seemingly entertaining shows. Shows that have made him a rich and famous man in recent years. He is invited to TV shows to show everyone his wild animals. Duck Antel's fans are also fond of getting close to his animals and touching them. A dangerous, unique, and strange experience. Versus Joe Exotic and Duck Antel is Carol Baskin, a woman who calls herself an advocate of animal rights and has established a complex in the state of Florida to keep felidae. Baskin's complex is a collection of felidae who, for whatever reason, are unable to return to nature. Animals that have been abused by people like Exotic and other private owners. Baskin's controversial fight with Exotic and Antel is also about the same issue. During the past years, Baskin has been following Exotic step by step. His employees, like secret agents, monitor the movements of Exotic and his group to prevent their shows, sending emails, visiting in person, and persuading people to reject Exotic and his group are considered Baskin's works. Baskin has accused Exotic of illegal buying and selling, violence, murder, breeding and making money from animals. Accusations that have been brought to official authorities. Authorities that are going to approve a controversial law against people like Exotic and Antel.
Big Cat Public Safety Act would end the ownership of big cats as exotic pets and prohibit exhibitors from allowing the public to have contact with them.
Of course, in all these years, Exotic has resorted to countermeasures. He and his group have been engaged in physical and psychological war with Baskin for years, a fight that has reached the point of making public threats. Exotic is practicing every day with his new weapons to kill Baskin, and Baskin is trying to shut down Exotic's zoo by launching a campaign. This controversial dispute has gained other dimensions over the past 2 years. Some say that Baskin's goal is not protecting animals, but removing a competitor. It is clear that if Exotic and Antel zoos are closed, the number of Baskin's visitors will increase. The result of this strange competition, which has spread further in the absence of law, is 2 criminal cases so far. In the first case, Exotic was sent to prison on the charge of hiring an assassin to kill Baskin. In the second case, Baskin was charged with the murder of his second husband, a man that, according to what Exotic claimed, may have been eaten by Baskin's tigers. The controversies of private zoos in the U.S. are not limited to cases like Joe Exotic and Carol Baskin. The strangest of these cases was the incident that happened in 2011 in the state of Ohio. It was October 18th of that year when a resident of Zanesville, Ohio, saw several wild animals around his house. A few minutes later, the police were called, but the number of wild animals was much more than the police thought. One could guess where these animals came from. From the house of a strange man named Terry Thompson, a man who has been famous for his personal zoo for years. In addition to controlling the situation, the police wanted to know exactly what's happened. Police officers were able to shoot 48 wild animals by late evening, 18 Bengal tigers, 17 lions, 6 black bears, and many other animals. A terrible sight was made from the scene of killing these animals. a sight that may have seemed unavoidable to protect the people of the neighborhood and to prevent a human disaster. A few hours later, the police were able to find Thompson's dismembered body in his animal's cage, a body that, in addition to deep wounds, was hit by a bullet. Terry Thompson was a veteran of the Vietnam War, a man with strange attitudes, an outlaw and crazy about wild animals. Over the years, he had amassed a collection of all kinds of vehicles, weapons, and of course animals, and he had his own zoo. A few months before that incident, Thompson was sent to prison on the charge of possessing illegal weapons. But after his release, everything changed. His deep disagreement with his wife made him think of revenge, a revenge centered on animals, which his wife was also very fond of. The police investigation showed that Thompson freed all the animals from their cages first and shot himself later. Although Thompson's wife returned the surviving animals after a legal battle, but that was not the end of private zoos. There are still many people like Thompson and his wife living all over the United States. Private zoos that are not known what harm will they inflict upon the animals and people of the neighborhood in the absence of law.
Last fall, we brought in a new silverback to the Cincinnati Zoo, and today Harambe is making his debut in the gorilla habitat.
Witness to this claim was a tragic incident that happened to Harambe at Cincinnati Zoo. Critics of this incident said that gorillas are smart, that they have a high ability to understand the situation and to think, that Harambe could live somewhere else other than Cincinnati Zoo in a natural environment away from humans. It could not be exploited for generating income and it could still be alive. For centuries, a large part of human food and clothing has been provided by animals. But humans' behavior towards these creatures is in no way compatible with their valuable services. They are physically and mentally tortured to be an excuse for saving humans' lives and their entertainment. Incidents that constantly occur in zoos and medical laboratories. In fact, there is an obvious contradiction in the treatment of some humans towards animals. An obvious example of this contradiction lies in the pet industry. Capturing, killing and torturing some animals while the pet market is getting bigger with weirder dimensions day by day.
There are a lot of people today who say that zoos should shut down. What do you think?
I think those arguments of zoos being part of the problem and using animals and having massive welfare issues and not educating the public and not doing conservation was true.
Years ago, the French philosopher René Descartes commented on animals. He described animals in cages as emotionless machines. He emphasized that compassion for animals is irrational. No one needs to think about their food and comfort. He used to say that we should treat them as we please. We should force animals to work. We should kill animals, hunt them, and sacrifice them for medical experiments. It should be said that, despite the fact that four centuries have passed since Descartes made these comments, our current situation is not much different from that of Descartes. A look at zoos shows that we are crueler than the time of Descartes. The cause of animal suffering and the main reason for their extinction.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
Amid warnings by the United Nations of a looming famine in the blockaded Gaza Strip, which the United States enabled for nearly 5 months, Washington has now embarked on a new public relations campaign. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, three American military aircraft airdropped about 36,000 food parcels over a tiny region with a 2.3 million population, which has been reeling under U.S.-backed Israeli regime bombing since October 7th. Unsurprisingly, U.S. military cameras were on standby to capture the moment when the aid was being loaded into the aircraft at night and the cargo later dropped from the sky. Many rightly saw it as a photo opportunity to mitigate domestic and international public anger for Washington's direct complicity in the worst humanitarian catastrophe currently unfolding in Gaza. The flashlights were switched on to add that extra dramatic Hollywood-style war element to the whole charade, with troops loading the cargo on a C-130 Hercules military jet in the middle of the night. The U.S. Central Command published the videos for global news media outlets, many of whom played along by broadcasting the warlike footage. The Biden administration tried to get a message across that the U.S. military is helping to ease the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza while being the mastermind and architect of their colossal tragedy. The U.S. cargo landed along the Gaza coast, some in the sea itself, and for each U.S. food parcel, hundreds of starving and desperate Palestinians rushed to get a hold of it, drawing criticism from aid agencies and rights groups. Tens of thousands of others walked back to their makeshift tents, hungry and traumatized. For 5 months, they have been struggling to survive amid relentless bombings and crippling siege. The U.S. airdrops of food were inefficient because only small amounts of aid can be dropped at a time from a plane in what was a major operation for all the wrong reasons. It is another darkest stain in the history books for the United States regime, which has allowed the Zionist regime to kill and starve families instead of applying pressure on Tel Aviv to at least turn the water taps back on. If the White House was serious about helping the starving Palestinians, Biden could ring Tel Aviv and force the regime to open the land crossings to Gaza for real aid to enter, a key demand of UN agencies. However, that is not the case. The United States regime is directly aiding and abetting this genocide. Historically, in cases such as the Second World War, airdrops were used as a last resort. It shouldn't be a last resort for Gaza today, where the large majority of the 2.3 million Palestinians are on the verge of famine or deliberate starvation, while food and water are a few kilometers away. The Biden administration reportedly sent three C-130 Hercules aircraft over Gaza. One military cargo plane holds the equivalent of one truckload of aid. We keep hearing that Gaza needs an estimated 500 trucks of aid every day at minimum. 500 trucks of aid is the pre-war figure that wasn't enough then. The trucks required today to feed the starving people of Gaza is much higher. Yet, 500 trucks are waiting just across the border in Egypt to enter Gaza, and the Zionist regime with America's backing is preventing them from crossing. They are opting instead for airdrops, which may come across as compassionate to some watching on TV, but the reality is it degrades Palestinians who have been devalued as human beings for nearly 5 months now. Rightly so, the U.S. measures have backfired, drawing sharp criticism from aid agencies and rights groups. Medical Aid for Palestinians said in a statement, "Instead of dropping packages from the sky, some of which end up in the sea or outside of Gaza, and which the most vulnerable cannot reach in any case, the U.S., the U.K. and others should ensure that Israel immediately opens all crossings into Gaza for aid and aid workers to assist those in need." The International Rescue Committee said airdrops are not the solution to relieve this suffering and distract time and effort from proven solutions to help at scale. What makes this remarkably shameful for the Biden administration is that not only has the White House enabled the starvation to be used as a weapon of war in Gaza, collective punishment is a war crime, but it is American weapons that have murdered and starved the Palestinians. The Zionist regime war on Gaza is enabled by arms made in the United States, which is pulling the strings in the war on the besieged territory and using its veto power at the UN Security Council to avoid a ceasefire. These airdrops are also inaccurate, as the US military has no control over precisely where the cargo will fall, leaving the dangerously large pallets parachuted off the back of planes to potentially land on a crowd of people in what is a very densely populated strip. And if they land in the sea, there is a serious risk of Israeli regime warships shooting at Palestinians desperate to collect them, with similar deadly incidents happening many times in the recent past. The UN has warned that famine in Gaza is inevitable unless aid deliveries increase significantly, with a quarter of 2.3 million population one step away from starvation. Starvation has already started to take the lives of Palestinian children. The World Health Organization data shows at least 10 children have been officially registered in a hospital as having starved to death. Highlighting the crisis in Gaza, a WHO spokesperson said, "The unofficial number can unfortunately be higher. The footage from Gaza looks like a powerful natural disaster has hit the territory, but this is nothing natural. The latest decision by the Biden administration highlights how much of a U.S.-Israeli man-made disaster the Gaza Strip has become. This is despite reports surfacing of Palestinians eating animal feed to survive and children dying from starvation as a result of malnutrition and dehydration."
Start. Movement. Speed. Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim. I am a Muslim. Islamite. Islamite. Allah my Lord. Allah my Lord. His word Quran. His word Quran. Muhammad Prophet. Muhammad Prophet. Praise be upon. Praise be upon. I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. Well, once more, I am honored to be here. And this is Asma. Well, I'm not alone. I have a co-host in here, Brother Mustafa.
Assalamu alaikum. So happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's always happy to be in Youth Station in the holy month of Ramadan. The people have got different conditions and situations. Like, there are many people, not everybody has got this blessing to live in a Muslim country. Well, everybody is familiar with the concept of fasting, the concept of holy month, with the concept of practicing what God has asked us to do. So maybe for those people who are living in the other parts of the world where people do not have a clear vision of what's going on, why people are fasting for such a long time, maybe that's going to be a bit of difficult.
So I've gone through that myself personally. I've lived in countries, you know, non-Muslim countries in the West where I had to fast. And yeah, it is, it's a different feeling, definitely. You know, I used to miss like my home and Ramadan, like the Ramadan at home way more during that month than any other month, because it reminded me of so many things. Like, you know, people in my office where I was working, there was, I think I was the only Muslim person there, right? So I was the only person fasting. Everybody else was like eating and having fun. And, you know, they're going about their normal day. I was the only one who was sort of like fasting. So it's not easy.
No, it's not easy. And also you mentioned about home. When you're back home, You see that in this month, everything changes, like even your home, the schedule of the home is going to change, like you're going to go to different phases, like you have the time when you're going to break your fast, when you're going to start your fast. So things are going to be different, and the conditions of the city, that also has a great impact on you. When you are in a non-Muslim country, you are going to miss every single detail about your hometown where all the people are Muslim, and it's very clear from the face of the city that everybody is getting engaged in a ritual.
Right, and even office hours in many Muslim countries change, right? Whereas when I was, you know, in a non-Muslim country, I had to go to the office the same as everyone at the same times. But I can tell you that the fasting was more difficult, but it was in a way more rewarding, right?
Yes.
Because I felt like I went through
because
more
difficulty. Because you're going through too much.
But it was also a rewarding experience from, I would say, from the non-Muslims, right? Non-Muslims will then, they sort of become curious about what you're doing and how you're feeling, you know, and they'll talk to you more about your faith during that time. So it's sort of like an invitation to discuss faith and religion with other people, right?
Yeah.
So that would make it a rewarding experience
exactly.
as well.
Yeah. So I have heard a lot about those people who are not familiar with these concepts, like when a person who's Muslim gets into their community, and just as you mentioned, like at your workplace, then they start to ask you questions. Maybe some of them don't like what you do. Maybe some of them appreciate what you do. But I guess the number of people who don't like what you do is more than the people who are going to appreciate you.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, okay? I think, at least in the places where I was, people did appreciate it, you know? Like, they... And one thing, by the way, what's become really common in a lot of Western countries is intermittent fasting. I don't know if you heard that term.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way of, like, fasting, which is different from Islamic fasting. But the whole idea is to, like, make yourself fit and, you know, if it's a diet. Or there's this thing called water fasting where people will only drink water for, like, it's crazy amount of days, for, like, 30, 40 days, right? So...
I guess in Christianity, they have a ritual like this.
They have Lent.
They can drink water, but they cannot eat.
They have Lent in Christianity where they have to sometimes, they can give up anything they want. It doesn't always have to be just food. You know, maybe a habit that they give up for 30 to 40 days. Or sometimes, yes, it's food. So... And by the way, the people that don't maybe appreciate it, they will never express it to you openly, right? At least in the environment that I was in, I never faced any, like, you know, negative.
Nice.
I was maybe in a nice place or with a good.
Yeah,
you know,
maybe you were lucky.
I was in another place where we had non-Muslims. This was in a Muslim country, but we had a lot of non-Muslims working with us. And there were also Americans. A lot of them started fasting with us just to see.
So considerate of them.
Just to see what it feels like, right? They wanted to know what it feels like. And you will see that a lot of, like, non-Muslims then enjoy our sort of rituals and practices, right?
The perspective of Islamic fasting is totally different. And also the perspective is beautiful. This process of redefining yourself is an interesting thing. Like, you're going to go through a journey of soul searching, a process which is going to end so beautifully, and you're going to be rewarded for it. So let's keep it here, go for a short break, and then we'll be back to see what's more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So we're back from the break, and we've been discussing, you know, the experience of fasting and having Ramadan in non-Muslim countries, which I've really been talking more about my own personal experience because I've had that. One thing that I just remembered is I had a friend who was back in America, and he was more like towards the Christianity side and less maybe. But the interesting thing about him and why I bring it up is that he used to fast in Ramadan, right?
Nice, yeah.
Despite everything, despite whatever even if he wasn't like very religious, you know, or very practicing in his day-to-day life, I remember during Ramadan, he would fast because he actually genuinely enjoyed that feeling.
I said previously, like, it's a beautiful month and everything about it seems at least so beautiful. Like, apparently what you see, what's going on in a Muslim family is so interesting. People invite each other to each other's house. Mm. Then they, it's as if it's a party.
Right.
Like, they have a special rituals. They have a special foods even for those days, like special sweeties. Everything is different, so it seems to be so beautiful, like for those people who do not know what's going on. But yeah, for those who know, it's totally another story.
The amazing thing is that when you do remain hungry for the sake of God, you know, God will not waste your sort of sacrifice, or
of course.
even if maybe your intentions are a little bit different. I would say that, for example, this friend of mine that I mentioned, I think during those times, he would maybe spend more time than thinking about, you know, religion.
Yeah.
Or religious issues. And I can tell you the good news is that after this was, I'm talking about like about almost 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Is it 20 years ago? I'm getting pretty old. So it was about 15 years ago, okay?
Yeah.
I'm still in touch with him, by the way. And he's definitely become much more towards Islam. And he's much more of a Muslim now than he was maybe back, you know.
So nice.
So I think, you know, that's part of it is him being rewarded for even fasting, right?
Yeah, still, we said it again that even those people who do not fast are going to benefit from the benedictions of this month.
Yeah.
So in the end, it depends on your essence and on your soul. So since we were talking about how to cope up with this situation in the holy month of Ramadan in other countries, like non-Muslim countries, I guess it's going to be more difficult for children, like for the youngsters. That's going to be much of a drudgery.
Yep, I've experienced that as well. And I experienced that when, you know, fasting was like from like 4 a.m. to like 9 p.m. or something.
Yeah,
I was in a place where
so
like fasting
long.
Was really long. And I was going to school as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It was very difficult during those times. But now that I'm older, I feel like it was much easier to fast as a child, as a kid, maybe as a teenager,
mm-hmm.
than it is to fast as an older person.
I
don't know if you know what I mean.
But I understand, but I guess for children, like to express themselves, to defend themselves when there is a pressure from the other peers, like, why are you doing this? Like, you know, degrading them, like all this stuff are nonsense and things like that.
But, you know, when you're in that sort of society, when you do face that sort of challenges, like maybe racism or somebody who doesn't understand your religion, it makes you stronger as a Muslim. Right?
Yeah.
I remember that I would sometimes get, you know, I was only 13, 14 years old, but sometimes you would get into debates about religion. And I had people, I had like, you know, Christians, Jews, Hindus, like Buddhists, all type of people in my school. I would have to sometimes many times go back and like research and look up like answers to their questions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that environment automatically makes you stronger as a Muslim. Like,
there are two sides to it. Like, what if you were not the type of a researcher, like a person who wants to get an answer?
Yeah.
Like if you were a child who just wanted to know everything by practice, like whatever I know, then that would be a difficult time.
It would be difficult.
For parents and for them children.
I think a big role, parents can definitely play a big role in that, you know, in guiding their children towards, you know, in that environment, definitely. That is really a big responsibility of parents then to, and one thing that really helps is in some of these places, you know, not all non-Muslim countries or cities have this, but at least thankfully the places that I was in, there was always a Muslim community.
Yeah.
So even in America, I remember my first month in the United States was during Ramadan, and you know, I ended up going, and there weren't any Shia mosque or, you know, centers. I ended up going to like a Sunni mosque for, you know, iftars, and they had iftar is the breaking of the fast, and they had an iftar every single night, right? And then I ended up meeting so many different people there and making friends that, you know, throughout the whole year, they helped me out then, right?
Yeah.
So having a community around you of Muslims is great
in those places. Helpful.
Yeah, in fact, that's really great. I think about
being and since not everybody is a part of your community, those who care for you are going to have a special place in your heart.
Right.
So you're going to find your own community in there. So that is difficult, and at the same time, it would lead to your growth.
Yeah, yeah.
So we can go for a break,
sure,
and then come back with more.
So one thing that in a non-Muslim country, many times, you know, things are quite black and white, right? They're very clear, like what's right and what's wrong is many times clear because mm-hmm. it's like you're the Muslim and they're the non-Muslim. So you can sort of, even with your children, you can sort of differentiate, you know, the differences between that. And you, like I said, you have the sense of community. If I were to compare that being in a Muslim country many times, things aren't always black and white, right? Because you're sort of like mixed together,
yeah.
it's sort of sometimes harder to distinguish what's right and wrong sometimes.
What is what? Which is which?
Yeah. So there's definitely benefits to being, you know, in that sort of environment.
It's a challenge because...
And on the flip side, like you said, not everyone may have that positive experience. Yeah. Unfortunately, many times people then fall as well, right? They'll
exactly.
fall and they'll get misguided.
And they get into wrong communities.
And yeah, and they may end up becoming even more distant from. So it's, you know, it can have a polarizing effect. But we hope and pray that, you know, it has a positive impact on the people that are there, that it does make their faith stronger. And we pray, you know, God helps
exactly.
guide them in those situations.
And of course, it's a practice. You must practice on yourself more and more.
Yeah.
So whether it be in your hometowns or in other countries where people do not very much know about
right.
your religion and your rituals. So it's going to be a challenge. And I hope all these challenges come
yeah.
out in a way that would lead us into a better place,
right.
not into nowhere.
Well, life is a test no matter where you are on
of
earth.
Of course.
You know, whichever community you're in, the best way is to protect ourselves is to practice piety. And, you know, that is what God tells us to do.
Ask God for help because he's going to watch over you.
Right.
And that's going to be a lot more easier when you ask him to help you.
Yeah.
So this was all.
That's all the time you have today. Please continue listening to Youth Station. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thank you, brother. And thank you, dear listeners. Until another session, we just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
I will tell you, dear youth, that the future belongs to you. By Allah's favor, you, dear youth, will see that day. And you will hand down your sources of pride to the future generations. Greetings, be upon you and Allah's mercy and blessings.
And inshallah, we will continue talking about
this. We'll discuss that inshallah in the next session. Wassalamu alaikum
warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. And don't go away.
We will continue this very essential topic with our great youth.
Wassalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Ya Latif, Ya Latif, Ya Latif. Ya Latif, Ya Allah, Allah, Ya Allah, Allah, Ya Allah, Allah, Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM, 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.